Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 51 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, a.k.a. All Day Ray, a.k.a. Daddy Joystick. And I'm joined here by my nefarious co-host, former market maker, 20 years and current day retail trader. I'm talking about Hal Street's own Allen Iverson for the amount of traders that he's turned inside out. I am talking about the man who always speaks at a soothing decibel level, my co-host, DJ Magic VWAP. JJ, how's it going?
Hey, brother. Good, brother. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Doing great. And now our guest today is a recognized industry expert in futures and hedge funds and the author of a number of widely acclaimed financial books. He is perhaps best known for his best-selling series of interviews with the greatest traders and hedge funds managers of the last three decades. His prior experience includes 22 years as director of futures research for some of Wall Street's leading firms and a partner in the Fortune Group. Of course, I am talking about the market wizard himself, Jack Schwager. Jack, how's it going?
Oh, good. Thanks. Although I don't consider myself a market wizard, so I should... I just write about them. I don't claim to be one.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm curious myself about your trading background, and I'm sure just having access and talking to all these different people, I'm sure you've picked up so much things yourself. What has been the impact of it, you know, interviewing these traders on your own trading?
Yeah, well, obviously positive. It was actually the motivation for the first Market Wizard book was, mm-hmm. I thought it was a good way to kind of learn stuff and become a better trader. Although I was never a trader full time. It was always something on the side, sort of more like a hobby or whatever. So while I was working full time, you know, I might put on some trades. There are times where I trade, there are times where I don't trade. So it's never been like full time, but when I did trade or wanted to trade, I wanted to be better, which wasn't a very high bar because I started off as an awful trader and I still am not a great trader, but at least, you know, via interviewing a lot of people who knew what they were doing and were willing to talk about it, at least that was a transformation from being net negative to net positive, which is an important line to cross. So, I learned a lot of different things from the traders I interviewed. Definitely influenced me, as a trader. I'm definitely influenced as I hope many readers are, but.
For sure. Well, you know, it seems a common theme that most of the traders didn't start off as good traders. And that's probably, you know, it's something me and JJ talk about, that a lot of people who have success right away, it might actually be a detriment to their trading because a lot of times it's attributed to luck. And, you know, not necessarily skill and the process that you and so many of the traders talk about in your books. So, you know, it's a real honor to have you on. Jack, last week you hosted a segment for Chips for Charity, which was, you know, poker tournament. It was a real fun event. I had a pleasure of being a part of it as well. Big shout out to Troy Prince, two-time podcast guest, good friend of ours. How'd you get hooked up with those guys?
I forget, you know, basically they asked me to participate. I forget who did, but, you know, I obviously agreed. So I've done a number of webinars recently, so sort of hard to keep some of them straight, but certainly as a charity event, I was more than willing to do it.
Yeah. And for a great cause, it's Wall Street Bound. For the listeners, we had them on two times. Big shout out to Troy Prince. And just a reminder to the listeners, if you guys like to trade alongside JJ, myself, and a supportive community of traders, we trade futures, equities, and options at microefutures.com. Jack, just a little curious, you know, a little bit more about your trading history, how you came to love financial markets and your participation in them.
So unlike a lot of other people who end up being traders, I didn't have any ambition or thought of being a trader, or for that matter, even being involved in financial markets. I really fell into it by pure luck. I was out of graduate school with an economics degree. I was looking for an analytical job. And it so happened that the first job I ended up in was an analyst position for Futures Research Department. And that once you're working as an analyst in the markets, it's sort of a natural step. If your job is trying to tell people how to trade or what to trade or whatever, it's kind of natural that you want to try to trade yourself. And so that's how I ended up starting to trade. Of course, in the beginning, I knew nothing about trading, and having an economics degree was of zero benefit. If anything, it might have been detrimental and making me somewhat skeptical of technical side, and, you know, almost without thinking about it, the only approach I would consider would be fundamental, because that was more attuned to an economics type background. So anyway, that's how I fell into it. It was just by luck.
Yeah. You know, I think we had a former analyst, Walter Diemer, on for, he's an analyst for over 50 years. And that was something he was talking about, that how the skill set of being an analyst and a trader is like totally different, and that he couldn't trade himself, even though he was, you know, a really well-renowned analyst himself. So I always think on that, I find that interesting. So Jack, just quick thoughts on the resiliency of the market that we've seen this year.
I was completely caught off guard, because, you know, when we had the initial break, my response was to scale down orders, you know, pretty deep down, but based on retracement levels. And we never got to the top of the scale. Didn't miss the top by very much, but I never got down. And my thought was we'd get a bounce and we'd come down again. And I can't recall, you know, and I've looked at a lot of markets over the decades, and I'm not just talking about stocks, but, you know, and I'm not talking about stock indexes alone, but any futures markets or whatever, or, you know, interest rate markets, whatever. I can't recall a situation where we had like one giant decline and then just a giant rebound back to new highs without, you know, just like a V. Now you get V bottoms, but they're not just V bottoms. You know, you'll get the rebound, you'll come back, you know, the bottom itself may be V, but for the entire move down and up to be a V is pretty, you know, I wasn't expecting it. I was totally surprised. In fact, initially I didn't get the buy side. I had scale up sell orders, which I eventually pulled because the market action just wasn't right for it. But I totally missed it. Now we're new highs. Short-term market still looks bullish. I don't know. You know, I'm not a predictor. My prediction as what would happen on a rebound was certainly wrong, because I would have thought, well, you got a rebound 50%, maybe 60%, then you'd have enough a second test. Never happened.
Yeah, right. Definitely unique situation we got, JJ. Something you've never experienced either, right?
Well, in 30 years, I've never seen anybody. Well, I did some research, and we actually in April, after we looked at the 13Fs, we saw that the large time frame, longer time frame shareholders didn't sell any positions. So we knew that there was no supply. So I said, let's not short. This thing's going to go right back up, because I'm an ex-manipulator, and I used to manipulate, you know, under $20 NASDAQ so you could sell a large position. And when there's no supply, we just couldn't short. So we looked at the 13Fs, and I've never seen such large concentrations of positions in money management funds that are longer time frame that aren't selling. You know, you've got, you know, people with a billion shares of Apple, and it's not coming out, nor is there a liquid enough market to get it out if you had to. So it's we've gotten them so long that we can't sell.
Yeah. You know, and it makes me think of something that Jack, you wrote in the book, that the unknown wizards, you know, in the new book, they've had some of the greatest results that you've seen, despite professional managers accounting for an ever increasing amount, you know, of the percent of all of trading. How can that be?
Yeah, well, as you say, I was totally surprised. I didn't expect it. From the first Market Wizards book till now, we've seen just an enormous shift or, you know, of professional managers, namely hedge funds and mostly hedge funds, but, you know, others, accounting for a larger and larger piece of the trading pool. So, you know, it's like when you had a few professional traders, like in the first Market Wizards book, Michael Marcus describes it. He said, you know, he would get long, and like a week later, the densest of the world would get long, and he had a big profit and he'd get out. I mean, that's no longer, the dentists of the world no longer have a large percentage of the trading pool. Yeah. But you know, so I would have expected to be more difficult, if not impossible, to get sort of spectacular types of returns for a decade or longer. But you know, these people did, at least most of them. And you know, like I say, I don't have an explanation, just that they found a niche and they were extremely good, and they had the skills to be, you know, some people I think are just born traders. Mm-hmm. And it just demonstrates that despite the shift to so many more professional traders, it's still possible for the independent guy trading from his home office or whatever to still do extremely well. Of course, we're talking about a small percentage, but the possibility is still there.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's very encouraging, you know, for people like myself, I'm sure for the listeners as well. Do you think, you know, because where my mind goes, you know, and I'm not sure, but the only theory I can think of, do you think maybe, Jack, there's having a smaller account, there's some maneuverability and some advantages, and maybe not having, you know, because some of these guys, they have such large, you know, they're dealing with such large money. So I think that maybe there's some advantages to having a smaller account.
Yeah, that's always been true. It's always been, you know, I always thought that being a smaller trader is an advantage over being a big trader. A lot of people think it's the other way around. Well, you're a big trader, you get, you know, some, you get a bit more information, you get a bit of, but bottom line, the ability to get into the market and out of the market with, you know, no, as a nobody, you know, because you're too small to make a difference, is a big deal. It's a big deal. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's an advantage small traders have. They've always had it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. That's great. And something we need to embrace. So, Jack, so taking it back to the first book, which I believe was in 89, correct?
Yeah. It came out in 89.
So where did this idea come from to create the series?
Well, you know, most people think Market Wizards is my first book. It wasn't. I wrote an analytical book, sort of a reference work back about 5 years earlier called The Complete Guide to the Futures Markets, which got revised a couple of years ago. But that book, sort of, I took a sabbatical to write that book, and that was pre-PC. It was really an enormous amount of work. So I did that to put down a marker as, and I thought I could write a better book. You know, when I came into the industry, I didn't think there were any really good books on analysis of the futures markets. And, you know, even when I wrote that book, I still didn't think there were any really good books. And I thought I could do better than anything that's out there. So I just wanted to do it, not to make, you know, it's not to make money, because you don't write a book like that to make money. You write a book like that to just put, you know, to establish that, hey, you know, yourself as somebody, you know, who's got something to say that's worthwhile. And that book was successful for what it was. And I got approached to do other books by another publisher, which again, they wanted me to do a whole bunch of, to be an editor in chief for a number of analytical books. I said, hey, I've been there, done that, not what I want to do. But I'd like to do something more of like more of a broad audience book. And I had this concept, as we talk Market Wizards, go around the country, talk to the best traders and find out what do they do that the rest of us don't, and try to pick their brains. And I thought that would be A, useful for myself, B, a fun project, and C, probably a good idea for a book. So they said, yeah, that's great. Why don't you do that? And so that was a catalyst. I had the idea for several years, but I was a director of futures research, which is more than a full-time job. And I wasn't eager to try to do a book on top of that. But once I had to kind of say, oh, somebody give me the spur, okay, do it. You know, that, so it became a nights and weekend type of project.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So So Jack, so other than the, you know, technical or the technological improvements to trading, what's been the biggest contrast in the markets from the first Market Wizard to the latest?
Well, there's been a lot of them. For once, you know, back when I started, you know, for decades after, we were dealing with markets with pits, you know, for one thing, mm-hmm. as opposed to electronic trading. Oh. And in fact, the first exchange that tried, somebody was early, I forgot the name of some, they were on some island or whatever, they tried electronic trading, which I thought was a really good idea, but I forget why it didn't work initially. But about 10 years later, it you know, it got tried again, and that became, of course, it became all of trading virtually. So that's one big difference. The technological thing is really immense, is immense, because you had a whole bunch of approaches which were impossible to do. A lot of hedge fund strategies were not possible to do pre-computer. And a lot of hedge fund strategies were not possible to do pre-supercomputer power, like, you know. So there's definitely widened the amount of things that are being done in the markets. And it's also we have a tremendous increase in amounts of quantitative people in the markets. You know, back in the late 80s, yeah, you had some quantitative people, and you had somebody like Thorpe, who I interviewed in Hedge Fund Market Wizard, which was the previous Market Wizard book, who was probably the first, really the first quant, may well have been the first real quant, because he started, I think, in the 60s, late 60s. So you did have people like him, but they were just like, often like me, you know, and, you know, the real emergence of these huge, you know, multi-billion dollar quant shop, tens of billions of dollars on the management, with hundreds of quants working for them. That's a whole different world. And that didn't exist at all, couldn't exist, because, as I said, you didn't have the computer power. So it's a combination of the computer power and the people and highly quantitative people coming into the industry. Which is also a difference, you know, big difference.
For sure. Out of all the traders that you've interviewed over the years, how many traders would you say are kind of like their feel traders there? They trade off the intuition. I would imagine that's like a rare combination. And do you think people can succeed that day, currently trading like that?
Well, it's not, you know, intuition is part of it, but if you want to make it a little broader, using the word discretionary traders as opposed to, you know, intuition, because discretionary traders may have very specific methodologies. They're not programmed. They may have basic concepts, and they have some intuition probably mixed in there. Sometimes it's a very heavy dose of intuition, but most times it's just a discretionary methodology. And I think it's a better category to talk about. And I would say that the majority, probably a good majority of the people that I interviewed were discretionary traders as opposed to systematic traders. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's very difficult, with the exception of firms like Renaissance, you know, which are kind of unusual to get sort of spectacular performance on a quant approach. There are some of those firms, okay? But that's really a little bit different than when we think of systematic trading. It's not one or a couple of people using a system they've built. We're now talking about firms which, like I said, may have 100 plus quant people devising systems which run together. They may have scores of systems running simultaneously, trading 10,000 plus securities across the range, you know, the underlying securities, the derivatives of all types, and cross relationships, and they're looking to pick up, you know, slight inefficiencies in relationships of different markets. And so these are highly complex things that really take huge teams and huge computer power to make possible. And that's not the type of thing when people talk about systematic trading. So excluding that type of exception, it's difficult to find systematic traders who have extraordinary performance. Yeah, you can find plenty of systematic traders who have good performance and earn a living, you know, maybe for all their life trading, but you're not going to get Sortino ratios of, you know, 10 plus you know, on systematic trading, with the exception I noted. You're not going to get somebody turning. Well, I mean, this book is an extreme example. One traders turned 2,500 into 50 million. Last time I spoke to him, it was up to 80 million. It was 50 million when I wrote the book. You're not going to get that on any type of systematic trading. Just impossible. So that takes like an extraordinary trader, like earning hundreds of percent a year sometimes. And that's, you're not going to get that on the system.
Yeah. That trader you mentioned, I forget his name, but he was the trader you were a little reluctant to include in the book at first, correct?
Well, I was a rookie. He actually contacted me. Mm-hmm. And this is a guy who's, I mean, truly unknown, low profile, nobody, just trading from his own home, has been doing it from, I think about 2005, the last 15 years or so. And he just sent me this email saying, you know, you may not believe this, but I turned a $2,500 account into 50 million, or whatever it was. Maybe it was a little less. I think it was about 50 million at the time. So I said, I'm not doing, first of all, you're skeptical, right? But I said, not a problem, because I would never include somebody who sends me an email like that unless I actually got the results. And what I basically said, look, I'm not planning to do a book in a foreseeable future, but if things change, that's an incredible story. And if you're if you're willing to share your statements, I'll let you know. So it turned out, about 6-9 months later, I did decide to do this Unknown Market Wizards book. And I contacted him. I said, I'm doing another book. I am doing a book. I think you'd be great, but I need to see the statements. And he was very cooperative. He literally sent me all the statements. It was for real, So it wasn't that I didn't want to include him. It's just that, I wasn't ready to do a book then. And when I was, of course, I needed to see the evidence. And he was always open about doing that.
Yeah. I mean, he had a unique approach at first, right? Because he was trading, I believe he was trading penny stocks. He was trading off the spread, correct?
Well, that is very, very first approach. I mean,
right.
The very, very first thing he did is he noticed that there were these stocks which just were, first of all, he came in with this ridiculous objective of making $1 million in his first year. Mm-hmm. And he figured out how much he had to compound daily to get the $1 million. And this is crazy. I don't advise anybody to think like this, but sure. I mean, it worked for him, but I think he's 1 in 100 million. Right. And so that was his objective. So he's looking for stocks that moved a lot. He discovered, hey, the stocks that move a lot are penny stocks. And then he discovered there are these stocks that trade, like at this range, like between 7 cents and 8 cents or whatever. And they just all year. And then we dug into it. He found out that they went to decimal point, decimal trading, whatever. But there were some brokerages which only allowed you to trade round cents and or to the 10th or whatever. So he found, but there were brokerages that you could only trade 7 or 8. So it was always bid 7, offered 8. And so his broker, you could put in fractions. So he, initially he started out buying like at 7.01 and selling at 7.99, that type of thing. And of course, as this thing became more known, that spread, narrower and narrower, narrow until it got to the point where it's no longer, it became a matter of buying it at 7.50 and selling it at 7.16. It was no longer, the same strategy, but that's what he got started doing. And that worked for him for a while.
Yeah. It was definitely, that was an interesting interview for sure. And certain parts of that interview, I guess on the surface, some of the trades he made almost look like, luck played a factor in some of them. And what it makes me think on a broader sense is with a lot of these people, how much do you think, obviously all these guys are highly skilled for sure, but how much do you think luck plays into someone's success as a trader?
Well, over the long term, I don't think it's an important element. Over the short term or any particular trade, it can be. And, I have a number of stories. Actually, I can think of two things in the book, in that chapter, his chapter, which were definitely luck played a role. But he made something up the luck. So it's not, you know, it's not just the luck. It's the fact that you can, that you have what it takes to capitalize on the luck. So, you know, I had one story where he bought the stock, which was a heavy promoted stock. And he first got in because he saw this huge amount of insider buying, like half the float or something got absorbed by insider buying, something crazy. And so he knew, figured, so he got long. And that's why he didn't know anything. And the idea, it was like, it was a stock called SpongeTech. And when, and he always orders the product of any stock he buys. And the product was, it was a sponge. It was a sponge with soap in it. It wasn't exactly a high-tech thing, but he liked the product. And anyway, it started going up. And the thing about SpongeTech is they advertise in all these sports events. So, you know, if it was a tennis tournament, you'd see a SpongeTech, you know, a SpongeTech on the screen, or, you know, or it was a, you know, football thing, games. And so they got very popular. And he recounts how friends were asking him about this, who knew nothing about stocks, just because they watched sports and they were seeing, you know, the thing advertised, and it kept on going up. So he bought it like at a buck or two. I forget exactly where, something like that. And it went up to 10, went up to 15, went up to 20. Anyway, yeah. In the summers, he found, he takes off a few months in the summer because he finds the summers are not a really good time to trade stocks. He only trades long. So he found it's useful. First of all, he wants it. He likes to travel, and he's been in like in God knows how many countries, but he takes the summers off. And so he's in, he's on safari in the middle of Africa. He doesn't have any communication. He can't enter any orders. All he has is his BlackBerry. And the thing about BlackBerries is that you can't communicate with the outside. You know, you can, when there's no communication, you can still communicate with other BlackBerry users.
Exactly, pin messages.
I'm not a BlackBerry user, but that's what he told me.
It's called a pin message.
Okay, so he's in the middle of nowhere. And one of his friends who went long, you know, on his advice, you know, contacts him and he said, you know, for message saying SpongeTech is, you know, 25. And this is like crazy. So the instant he sees this, he can't put an order in. There's no way to, he goes to the front office. He somehow manages to get patched in, you know, however he does it, to a point where he can put in an order and he gets out of all of the SpongeTech. He goes back to his tent. And 10 minutes later, he gets a message from his friend saying, you know, what, SpongeTech is down to $5. What do I do? And it literally went in one day, and I went back to look at it. And you can see this one day, it's like up in the high 20s and then goes all the way back down to like $5 or something.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it was lucky that he got that message for sure. But he acted on it instantaneously, even though it was very difficult. So it's like a perfect example of where there's luck. But he capitalized on the luck. He had the instinct to know exactly what to do, you know. And if he had hesitated or thought about it, or said, "I'll figure it out tomorrow," it would have been over.
It's funny you mentioned that deal. I ran the distribution on it.
Huh.
We did $125 million of dollar volume in one day. We liquidated $70 million worth of stock into retail buying. It was a good day.
That's funny. Yeah, JJ, you like this. I remember the story, Jack, because he went back to the hotel and he bribed the front desk lady to like let him use the
computer. Yeah. It was like, you know.
Yeah, something of that nature. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a front office. It wasn't a hotel. We had phones and stuff. It was, I think, probably one of these situations where you had these, you know, maybe luxury tents or whatever. Yeah. But you didn't have communication. You didn't have phones.
Yeah, so you had I was a consultant on that deal. That's a small one.
Were you?
Yeah.
He would be.
They paid me very nicely.
Do you have more to add to that story?
Well, no, it was just a complete scam. And honestly, I thought when I did my due diligence, because all I did was I run markets. So if you have 300 million shares of some garbage stock to dispose of, I'll help you run the market so you can get rid of that into liquidity. I help create liquidity. That's what I've done for my whole life. And these guys needed a favor. So I helped them engineer a bit of a short squeeze and do some work with DTC so you could, you know, demand delivery back in those days. And it got really, and the thing was, the guy who brought me the deal said, you know, they're doing all this advertising. It's a legitimate company.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, okay, it's a sponge with soap in it. That's fine. But they're going to give me 1 million shares to just work on the deal. So why not? Right. And yeah, so it's just funny because I remember
that's
when it was
going. That's amazing that you were.
Because I was getting nervous when we started breaking $15. I was like, you guys want to put out some paper because this is the FBI is going to be coming to the door here. Somebody sell some stock.
Yeah.
And literally the guy who held the convertible debenture or whatever it was, he got locked up at the brokerage house and they wouldn't let him sell. That's why the price jumped because, and when we were like, somebody sell somebody, you, I don't have any, we don't have any, nobody had any stock to sell because the buying was so much that it actually took us out of all our position, which
wow,
it's a beautiful thing when that happens. But
yeah, and actually the thing that there was a scam, they not only was it a scam, but it turns out that they also stiffed the sports.
Oh, that guy, he took everybody. He took everybody to the jail. He took everybody to the cleaners. I think he ended up in Club Fed. Yeah.
But, and that was an amazing thing because I always thought like penny stocks when I learned that that's how he made, you know, and he still trades. He still likes really micro cap stocks. Of course, now he has a lot more money, so it's a lot more difficult. Yeah. But I always had an impression that this was just like, it's a way people, naive people lose money. And so it's amazing that he was able to actually, profit tremendously. Not that he had any, he never had any inside information or, or involved in any of these things, but just took advantage of it. And
I just got to say, I never ever thought in my wildest dreams that I'd be talking to one of the heroes of my trading life and talking about SpongeTech, SPN. life is just amazing.
Well, that was a hell of a story. It's
amazing, right? Because every time I do these deals, I'd remember your book, and I'd go, oh, Jack Schweiger would not be proud of me. I'm not.
it made it in one of the books. That's funny. Well, you know, Jack, that's really kind of the premise behind starting this podcast was, JJ kind of shedding light on some of these things because, like you're saying, there might be very few people, very small percent who can actually make money trading these type of things. Otherwise, like you said, these things are set up for people like JJ to fleece retail money. And so that's how this even kind of started, with just JJ kind of letting this be known, because there's a lot of people who preach trading these things. And, it's tough.
I'm looking for redemption, yes.
Yeah, and he's looking for redemption for his old ways. But, Jack, one of the – probably my favorite interview of the book and favorite trader was Jason Shapiro. And I know you wrote he was hesitant and even declined at first to be a part of the book. So I'm glad you got him and you locked him down. His – I guess what I really liked about him is his contrarian approach – is one, I guess, that kind of appeals to my gambling background as well. And I loved how he used that analogy with the football spread and when people are on all one team.
Right.
And so, yeah, can you just speak to his contrarian approach and what you think about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it works. Jason's a very contrary. I mean, it fits. First of all, he's a perfect example. I always tell people in every book, I probably have the message is, find an approach that works for you, fits your personality. And he's kind of a poster child for that because, I mean, he's just inherently contrary. He always wants to be on the other side. He always wants to, he'll readily tell you that if he goes to a party and it's mostly liberals, he'll argue the conservative side. And if it's mostly conservatives, he'll argue the liberal side. And he'll do either one. It doesn't make a difference, And his point is, nothing is absolutely black and white. There's always something on the opposite side that's right. Mm-hmm. And he just likes being on the opposite side. And his basic premise is that if everybody is sort of convinced of one side of the market, then, there's just not going to be, the money's going to be on the other side of the market.
Right.
And so he tries to identify it. He uses the CFTC as a base for data. He uses the CFTC commitment to traders reports. But that itself is not sufficient, obviously, because you can be overbought or oversold for long times in markets and, you can go broke that way. But it's a matter of using those to identify markets where he's looking for a trade in the opposite direction. And then if he sees, for example, if he thinks a market is overbought and it's ready to, sell off, and let's say he's looking at news, whatever, let's say some news item comes out and the market doesn't go up, and maybe it goes to, maybe it closes weak. He'll look for something like that. He'll look for something in a market action which tells him, okay, here's a signal that the market is, you know, this could be the top, or it could be. So he's literally trying to get the tops and the bottoms. And he always has a, whenever he puts on a trade, he always has his exit point determined. And he said he will never, ever, ever, touch that stop. So that's the way he can pick tops and bottoms, because if he's wrong, he'll get knocked out pretty quickly. So he won't stay, he won't stay with a trend that's going against him. And his early career, first 10 years or so, he had made a small, he made like $1 million a couple of times and then blew it all because he didn't have that risk management. He was always contrarian. But so you get a market like the NASDAQ in the late 1990s. So he's looking at it and he thinks this is a bubble, this is crazy. Well, he was right, and so was Greenspan. And in fact, he mentions that day where Greenspan talked about irrational exuberance. And he thinks, Greenspan and me, the only guys who get it. Of course, that was about 3 years early. And the difference between Jason then, that's he eventually went broke. In fact, the only thing he left, the second time he went broke, he bought a Porsche on the, from his profits. So when he lost all his money again, at least he had the car left over. Yeah. Otherwise, he would have nothing. But those experiences taught him what was wrong. It taught him that, you can't just trade like that without having the risk management. And he would see then other people who would do what he did in those days, and he would almost use them as contrary indicators. He would spot those people, in his professional life, and he would identify them. And boy, if this guy's long, it's probably a good time to be short, because he saw in them, the same types of mistakes he was making in his early years.
Yeah, and I love it. It's such a unique approach. Me and JJ, we've often said, talk to people about like, hey, don't listen to CNBC, don't to these broadcasting stations, but he would listen to them and use them as his contrarian indicator. There was one guy he knew, he kept track of the guy's record, and the guy was always wrong, and he would just go opposite of the guy on CNBC.
Nice.
That would be one of the things he would.
Yeah, and no, that's not the only thing he would do. He obviously helps aid his process. And I just thought it was a real, unique way, and just picking out the people he knew were just bad, traders.
Exactly. Like on the desk, there was always some guy who was always wrong. So you always took the other side of his trade.
Yeah.
Right? It was just because you knew, right?
In fact, he talks about this. The March bottom that we had this past year. And he talks about like this conference call that from one of the firms he had worked at when he was managing money, within a hedge fund. One of the firms, which he gave up because he just wanted to be on his own. But a number of these guys would have still was in touch, and they would have occasionally have these conference calls. And that day where we had this one to the lows, where it was like huge panic, and they had a conference call that night. And ironically, so this guy, he said this guy was a perpetual bull. He was always bullish. And on this conference call, he said something like, we haven't seen capitulation yet. This is not the bottom. That's all he had to hear. This guy who was always a bull saying we haven't had capitulation yet. So he went long that night, not fully, but just on because that guy was saying it's not the bottom yet. And so he went long on that. And then the market had some action, which suggested it could be a bottom. Like it was more, they had some negative news that ignored or whatever. And it rallied the next day. And then he went fully long. But he used that actually as an indicator.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And just his whole story in general and his resiliency, like you said, the amount of times that he blew up. But he had the conviction that this is what I'm doing. He had like that unwavering determination, which I really respect. I really enjoyed his whole story. And then the last thing I want to ask about him is, because the real concept he wanted to get across to people in the book, that he says, and I'm going to quote him, he says the concept that market's discounting mechanism is based on speculator participation and not price is the most important thing. that I know. Could you elaborate on what he meant by that?
Well, you know, we're talking about, in that particular instance, are you talking about the CFTC numbers, just the price itself?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Are you talking about his use of the CFTC numbers or the price itself?
No, just the price itself. And I'll read it again, because this was like his closing kind of like statement, if I'm remembering.
Oh, yeah. I think I know. Let me just, I think I know exactly. The most important thing that there's the most important lesson that he could, in fact, it's like right at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So if I have a message to the world, I'm going to quote this.
Yeah.
If I have any message to the world, and this is the reason I agreed to do this interview, it is to convey the importance of participation. Everybody understands that the market is a discounting mechanism. What they don't realize is that the discounting mechanism is not price, it's participation. Mm. So it's not how high the price is going, how low. It's to what degree, are speculators, committed, versus commercials, which refers to the underlying commitment traders reports. It's not that the price has gone from 50 to 100 and therefore the bullish fundamentals are discounted. Instead, is that everybody's long and consequently the bullish fundamentals are discounted. So people might think, oh, this market is going up so much, it's got to be a sell. He says, it doesn't make a difference how much is going up, how much is going down. It doesn't mean anything until you actually see that speculators are overweighted to one side. So he said, so it's not that the price is discounting the market. It's not that the price is going up or enough or down enough to discount the situation. It's that the participation of speculators has gone extreme enough to discount the situation.
Yeah, that's great. And you don't really hear.
That's a totally original type of thought.
For sure. And it makes, and that's why, Jack, I was saying, like, his style of thinking definitely correlates with the way I view the market. Like, I try and this is something I learned from JJ right here, is I try and be on the side of the sharp money. Not because I'm a retail trader myself, so I'm just trying to figure out what the sharps are doing and go with them. And that seems like his, style of methodology, as well as a trader. So I really enjoyed that one. JJ, I know I'm hogging all the questions here.
That's good. I'm just chilling, waiting. I'm just, I started out in this business in 1993. I got interested because I was a bouncer working at a nightclub and somebody gave me liar's poker one night, one of the traders from the VSC, Vancouver Stock Exchange. And I tell you, I was hooked. Michael Lewis is what got me in the business. But then I didn't know how the hell am I going to be a trader and how's this all going to work? And then I found Market Wizards. And from about 93 till about 97, and even after, there was a group of us all trying to get into the industry and trying to get on trade desks. And we carried Market Wizards around like a Bible. We were like, there was like a Jack Schwager cult. And we would be quoting your book all the time and making jokes up around, certain stories, like the legend of the Jade Master, right? Yeah, you'd be at a party and somebody would say something stupid and you'd go, Jade Master wouldn't approve, right? And it was like a cult, so I never thought I'd get to interview you, number one. Number two, your interview with Linda Ratchke is how I got a job, because I was like, how the hell am I going to get a job? Because it's kind of closed. Everybody's got their kid on the trade desk. All the deal makers have family, representing their accounts. And she said she got a job at Crown Zellerbach, which was close to the exchange, so she could network. So I put on a suit and went and got a government job so I could network and meet people there. And that's because of you and that interview. And the other thing that I'm just so grateful, because that book gave us hope, right? Not only did it teach us about the business and how these people think, but it gave someone who was 20, 22, you know, it gave them that hope that it could be done. And that was huge. And now even with the second book, I see that you're doing it with retail, you're inspiring and giving those people hope, because when you take the curtain away and you show people what's behind the curtain, it actually makes those things at least seem achievable, right? And I really want to thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely, it's, yeah. Yeah, that's been my takeaway from it too. Like when we were talking about earlier in the podcast, that the type of returns these guys were able to get managing their own money, is astounding. And that's inspiring, you know, it really is. And Jack, I want to ask you, because you have in the book, you have futures traders, then you have the equities traders, right, stock traders. Is trading just trading, or is there some fundamental differences between the two traders?
No, really, there is. You know, I just divide them. I've been doing that in every Market Wizards book, dividing them by types of traders. So, you know, typically equity versus futures, and in some books there's even, it's more fine, broken down more. But it's not because they're different. It's just they're trading different markets. The elements of trading successfully are still highly similar. The only difference might be, occasionally on a stock side, you might get people who almost bleed into a little bit on the, to the investment side. But that's only occasionally. It's not the norm. So for the most part, there's not any real distinct difference. It's just they're trading different markets. But and a lot of times people trade both. So a lot of people in this book do trade the stocks and sometimes, so you do what they trade predominantly. Maybe it's more devised, but I know in a lot of the other Wizard books, there were a number of people who did trade both with, large commitments in each area.
Yeah, for sure. The last trade I wanted to ask you about and his methodology, because this one's definitely unique as well. I forget his first name, but last name, Camillo, the guy from Texas. And JJ, what this guy would do is he would monitor social media activity, and he built a huge team to search for or to like sift out certain words that would, he would just notice unusual social media activity first, and he was able to successfully use this information to trade, but he would try and sell this information to hedge funds and they weren't having none of it. Jack, what were your thoughts around him and his process?
Yeah, well, he was the most surprising in that he expanded my universe of what I thought trading could be. So before doing his book, it was like a coin could be heads or tails. You could either be you could either use fundamentals or technical, or some combination of the two, but there was nothing other than that. I mean, you could mix the two, or you can be one or the other, and each one within each sector, fundamental analysis or technical, there were unknown amount of approaches, but still everything fell into those categories, or so I thought. And so with Camillo, here's a guy who literally says, I didn't like fundamentals. He was like, I found them boring. I didn't want it to, I could never excel that way. There are too many guys who do the type of work. I don't want to do that. And he technical didn't work for him in charts. And so he didn't use either one. But what did work for him is picking up on social trends early. And it didn't make a difference what the price is. Didn't make a difference what the chart looked like. It didn't make a difference what the fundamentals were. He was trying to catch these trends early. Like he talks about, there's tons of great examples in that chapter, but say something like the iPhone, and he's out in Texas, right? But he speaks to people and, catch funds and whatever, and about this new iPhone thing, and they're saying, it'll never go. It's the receptor, because it first came out as was AT&T, and AT&T in New York City was horrendous. And so everybody in New York, which meant the vast majority of the financial community hated the iPhone because of the reception. But he's out, he's out kind of in not middle America, but more typical America. And he goes to the first party and somebody has an iPhone and he sees everybody's kind of buzzing around it, and you know, just everybody's crazy for it. So he kind of, he got it like 9 months earlier than the street did, because he saw how people reacted to it. So he's attuned to that type of stuff. Or, you know, PF, you know, restaurant chains like PF Chang or something like that, where, you know, New York, you know, hedge fund man, they'll never go to PF Chang ever in their life. But what he sees, what he sees here, people are lining up to go to a fast food restaurant. Yeah. And he kind of picks up on stuff like that. And so, you know, eventually, as you mentioned, he kind of built a company that computerized these things, and he uses, and he, you know, he used like Twitter predominantly, but he would use social media to pick up on not just individual words, but he would have these combination of words that he would look for, and it would tell him, it would give him like early insight, you know. So there's, and there's tons of examples where he did that, and he's done enormously well at that. So it's kind of incredible. He invented his own kind of type of strategy.
Yeah. The guy, even when you talk about his early ages, the guy's just a hustler, just a real entrepreneur
mindset.
So, you know, I could really appreciate that. And, you know, JJ, he, I have an affinity for Wendy's. He was able to pick up on the bacon burger. Pretzel bacon burger. I don't know. It was funny.
That was the thing. So pretzel cheeseburger. Yeah. So, one thing, he kind of does things, you know, like he went to the local Wendy, you know, not Wendy's in his area, and he would speak to Match, and they would tell him this thing is selling crazy. And then he would see on Twitter that he would compare the volume of the seasonal promotional, food compared to other fast food seasonal promotional. And it wasn't just that it was large, it was like much larger than anything else. So he thought it'd be enough to move the needle in a significant way, just from visiting local Wendy's and from you know, social media.
Yeah. Yeah, incredible. And I loved how he like almost, like he was like, Wall Street's slow on these things. And I'm like, what? Like, I've never heard like a retail person talk like that. I was like, but it makes a lot of sense, because he's in tune to certain things. Like you said, like these guys will never go to certain places. These guys are living in their like penthouses. They're not really tuned into like what the average American is doing. So I thought that was really neat. Just incredible. Like you said, just expanded like the horizon of what you think trading would be. And another thing with him, though, and I think really echoes through everybody, is they're all disciplined. You know, even if he knows he's not always right, he's like, this is not like the key to everything, but he uses it in his process. But he's not stubborn. He's disciplined, just like all these guys are, even though they have different methodologies.
Yeah, so he knows where he'll get out. You know, and it's and he's looking for an event. He's looking for something to, like, you know, based on what he's seeing in social media, he'll have an expectation for earnings. So once the earnings come out, he'll be out regardless, because he's not looking for any, doesn't make a difference how much more it's going to go or not going to go. He was looking to get ahead of the crowd. And once the news is out, now you have situations where hedge funds in more recent years have gone to like credit card data to get the jump on earnings, right? Because you could see maybe an activity showing up in credit card data. But he makes the point that he's, what he sees is before then, because people will start talking about it before it starts showing up in credit card data. So, you know, so he might actually, now as hedge funds are using that more, he might get out before earnings just on because hedge funds are seeing it in the credit card data. And he'll use that to know when the rest of the street knows what he thought he only knew.
Yeah, right. I love it. No, it's awesome. Jack, out of all the interviews that you've done over the years, and this might be a tough question, if you don't want to answer it, that's fine, but is there like a trade or two or three that really just stood out to you, like, man, like this guy's sharp, like this is there anyone that really stands above most of the people that you've talked to?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, stands above, because there have been so many brilliant people that I've, you know, interviewed over the years. So you want to, you know, say, so I mean, it could go on and on, like Kovner and Marcus and Paul Tudor Jones and Ray Dalio and Stanley Druckenmiller, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, but if I kind of had to say, this is one person kind of most impressive, maybe, would probably be Ed Thorpe, because he has, I mean, if this was like, if his life was fiction, you'd think it'd be made up because there's just so many firsts there. So this, he's the first one who figured out how to beat, you know, people thought like it was impossible to beat Las Vegas. You know, you couldn't do that, the odds, but he kind of figured out in two ways. So one was he figured out like in blackjack that if you could scale your betting mathematically. So, I mean, he figured out that if you could change the size of your bet to be bigger when the odds were better, you could take a losing edge and turn it into a positive edge. And so he wrote this book, which became a bestseller, Beat the Dealer. He changed the way Vegas operated. They went to multiple decks, frequent shuffling and so forth. But he actually figured out how to beat Vegas at their own game. And educationally, this is a guy who was writing his thesis for physics. He grew up in the Depression. He came from a very poor background. His high school, you know, he went to a lousy high school. So he kind of taught himself physics, and he did well, and he got like a super high grade, was able to get into one of the California universities. Then he was going for a PhD in physics, was writing his thesis, decided he didn't know enough math, took graduate math courses, got a PhD in math, never wrote his thesis in physics, so he's technically not a PhD in physics. Then he went outside, say, this thing, then he cooperated with one of the most famous scientists of the 20th century, Claude Shannon, who's called the father of information theory, and the two of them developed the first wearable computer. So they figured out how to beat roulette, which sounds impossible, but the way they did it is through Newtonian physics. They would actually time the spin of the ball and predict which eighth of the wheel was most likely to turn up. And one person had to kind of time it, the other person would place the bets, and they had to have a wearable computer that to kind of, when they press the thing that the ball passed the rotor, that set off the program on the wearable computer to beep and then stop at a do re mi sound, which was the octet where they would bet. So they developed a 40% edge on roulette. But that's just on the gambling side, that was that. And then he went on to finance. He really was the first market neutral hedge fund. He came up with the Black-Scholes theory, or the mathematical equivalent, years before, you know, Black-Scholes came up with it themselves, because, you know, they published it eventually, but he was using it for years. He was first, I think, to use convertible arbitrage as a strategy. He was maybe the first to use statistical arbitrage. So on and on and on. And his performance was like crazy. His first fund, 19 years, three losing months, all less than 1%. And, you know, I figured out the odds on that, and it's like absurd. I mean, it's like the most ridiculously low. I actually had to come up with an analogy, because the number is 10 to such a high exponent that you can't imagine it. But I worked out that it was the equivalent of, it was actually, his track record was less probable than picking an atom in the whole mass of the Earth, and then randomly picking another atom, and it was the same atom. So that probability is higher than his track record probability, if the efficient market hypothesis was correct. So of all the people, I'm saying, just because of his brilliance and all the things he did, you know, he also knew Madoff was a fraud like 10 years before Marco Polo wrote the paper. So just, and he has his own book, by the way. So I interviewed him my longest chapter was on Thorpe. And he has a book called A Man for All Markets, which is worth reading, which is even more detailed, a story of his life.
Definitely. I'm definitely checking that out. That's, I see why you picked him. Incredible guy. Wow.
Extraordinary. And with all that, he doesn't have the ego. I mean, he talks to you like you're on his level, you know, and he's not like some people who've really succeeded and kind of talk down to you. And he's like literally a good person. So I also liked him as a person, which is not always the case.
Right. That's amazing. And I'm sure And a lot, I think a lot of people don't think of it this way. This is the way I look at it. I'm sure that actually helped contribute to his success, not having much of an ego, because that can get in a lot of the, you know, a way of a lot of people. I know there's few rare exceptions, but, you know, especially in markets or just gambling in general, not having an ego, I think, is highly beneficial for sure.
Yeah, so.
For sure. Jack, I guess last question I have for you, passion for writing, has that always been there for you?
It was from the first book. I mean, I didn't know I was going to be a writer.
Yeah.
But I discovered, yeah, everybody has their own talent. My talent is not trading. I mean, you know, it's not my talent. I mean, I just, I might make money, a bit of money on it, but not much. But what I think I am good at is, you know, I think I'm okay as a writer. And particularly in trying to take things that are complicated sometimes and write it in a way where it's, you know, the average person can get it, you know, without making it overly, you know, so I think that's an ability I do have. So I do like writing. There is some satisfaction if you do something and it turns out okay. And you always hope it's going to be okay. You know, you think it is, but you never know for sure until you see the response.
Yeah. Well, really enjoying the new book. I'm almost through. It's did not disappoint at all. You know, we've touched on some of the stories. So for all the listeners, go out there and get it. We really appreciate you, Jack, you know, really dissecting these guys and what makes them successful. You obviously do a great job. You ask the right type of questions. We're just, you know, really grateful. So, you know, that concludes today's episode of Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed the show, please rate and review it for us. If you guys would like to learn market auction theory, market profile, trade futures, trade equities, and or options, come join JJ and I at microefutures.com. Jack, tell the people where they can find you and anything else you'd like them to know.
Sure. Well, you know, the book's obviously available anywhere, you know, Amazon, et cetera. I'm associated with a company, partner in a company called fundseeder.com. which is an analytical platform for traders. A number of the traders in this book came from that platform. I mean, the object of the platform is to identify undiscovered trading talent and to lure traders, but to give traders a reason to, you know, to provide free analytics, basically. Our interest is not to profit on that side, but rather to profit from connecting traders to investors through the investment arm of our company. And so that's fundseeder.com. And jackschwager.com is my website. I don't do much of it, but you know, you can find basically links to the books, the audios, a number of articles I've written, Twitter feed, etc.
Awesome. Do you do the Audible yourself, the audio version?
No. I hire somebody that's good. Okay. So actually, I've only had a few books where I had control of the audio. So it turns out my agent somehow got me to write spec for the audio on Newmarket Wizard. So I went through this process of Audible has an arm called ACX, and you could audition narrators, professional narrators. Mm-hmm. And I had like 40 people after the first few days, and I had to cut it off because I had 40 people, almost all of them were good. You know, quite a number were exceptional. So I got it down to like 10. And from that, I narrowed it down to 4. And finally, I just got, you know, I sent it to like 10 people who were involved in podcasts and other. So who do you think is best out of these 4? And the majority picked one person who I liked all of them. So I went with him and he did a great job. And then original Market Wizards audio, the publisher, you know, he had the narrator and it wasn't very, I didn't think it was a very good narration. And I finally got them to let me pay for another narration. So the same narrator now does that. And then when I did this book, I said, I'm not giving up the audio rights. And so I again got the same narrator. Name is DJ Halti. He's started out as an actor. He does professional narrations and stuff, and he's excellent. So those 3 books have the same narrator. And then there's Hetzel Marker Wizards is a good narrator, but a different one. And the middle book of Marco Wizards is another narrative. Those were the publisher picks.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Yeah, I always thought my co-host here missed one of his maybe in a past life he was a narrator, an audible man himself. With the amount of messages he gets from women from the podcast, it's incredible. I get none. I get
you'll be in trouble here.
I know. No, it was girlfriend I'm just joking around. JJ, parting words.
Oh man, well, thank you very much, Jack, for being with us. Really excited about the new book. Thank you for inspiring the old guys like me and inspiring the new young generation of traders. We owe you a huge debt of gratitude, showing us that, more than just learning how to trade, the whole, giving us that hope that it's possible by showing other people who have done it. I think that's very important for people who are out there slugging it. And, it's nice to have a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And you've always provided that for the last, 30 years. And we're very grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. So for Jack Schwager, I'm Paulie Walnuts. He's the gorilla of House Street. You stops.